25 minutes to 11, Alive 90.5 Spotlight with Jim and Darren.
Well, good morning, listeners, and thanks for being with us on Spotlight on Alive 90.5, a outlet that allows us to hear and learn about the world in which we live. Good morning, Darren.
Good morning, Jim. And it's great that, again, we have Steve Brown from Etienne Lawyers, who can tell us a lot about what you need to do with topics like wills, powers of attorney, guardianship. And you and I, we think we might know things about lawyers, but then we have people like Stephen on and we learn it's a whole different world. And so without further ado, we should cut to the expert. Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Very well, Darren. Very well, Jim.
Thanks for being with us. Darren, you and I were talking in the break. What's a question that you think may be fairly typical of people forward in the world in which you and I live?
Yeah, I think you and I, we may have parents who are getting on.
Yeah.
You will, and I do as well. No doubt most of our listeners will have parents who are getting on and considering their wills or updating their wills. Unfortunately, we may also hear of things like separations and divorces and things like that. So, Stephen, what I'd like to ask you is how complicated can these sorts of things get? Say if a couple who are maybe in their 80s get to a point where they have differences, they separate, but it may just be early times, they may not be divorced yet. What should such a couple consider, and our listeners may have parents in such a situation, what should they consider as they go through such a scenario in their lives and in the lives of their parents?
Darren, it's a nightmarish situation, both from an emotional level and certainly from a legal level. The position is that when a couple separate, they're still married. And therefore, if they die without a will, then the rules of intestacy, which we spoke about in a previous session, will apply. If they have a will, then their will still apply.
So the will's still valid, Stephen?
The will is still valid. Now, often, though, what will happen is that if person separates and they see a lawyer, one of the first things the lawyer will talk to them about, other than asking them for payment of account, of money of a cost, which is obviously what most people think lawyers do, is to ask them, you know, do they want to make a new will? And therefore, you can therefore have the couple make a new will, and therefore that new will be valid and binding, even though they have separated. The complicating factor then comes in is that, let's say, one partner makes a new will and they make the will such that they leave everything to their children, leaving nothing to their separated spouse. And if that person was then the first to die, you then have the following situation of the surviving spouse taking an application under the Succession Act, saying, well, I want a fair share because I didn't get any share. You then have complications of ownership of property. A lot of married couples own property as joint tenants. Joint tenancy has a doctrine known as the doctrine of survivorship, which for historical reasons means that when you have two or three people owning property as joint tenants, if there's two, on the death of the first, the whole property goes to the survivor without going through that person's will or estate. There's a legal fiction that the scintilla of time prior to death, the property is transferred from the dying person to the surviving person, such that that property that is owned as a joint tenant doesn't go through their estate. So if you've got a married couple, they've separated, and their property has been held as joint tenants, then you may find that even though the person's made a will, leaving everything to the children, there's nothing to actually leave to the children because the doctrine of joint tenancy, pass it all to the survivor.
Wow. So is there a way to take action to make this better, or does a person in that situation need to wait for divorce?
There are steps that, now, this is where the complications really start to come in. There are some court cases which indicate that the action of making a separate will can be construed as a severance of the joint tenancy, thereby terminating the joint tenancy, making it a tenant in common, such that half the property is able to be distributed. There are other court cases that say that that is an insufficient action and therefore further action needs to be taken. You can sever a joint tenancy by documentation, such that a separated couple, if the lawyer was advising them properly, would say, well, you need to, one, advise the other party that the joint tenancies are severed, and then if you can get their assistance to actually record the severance on title, which can be done, and thereby giving greater strength to the will. Of course, the other party may not be amenable to that course of action. The other thing that can happen is that if there is a separation, even though parties are separated, they can still apply to the family law court for a property settlement. So you do not need to divorce to have a property settlement. You simply need to separate.
That sounds like it's one of the best actions to take if both parties are amenable to doing that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you can do that by way of agreement under the Family Law Act, so you don't even need to go to court, or you can go and get what is known as consent orders if you want to do that. So they're the two ways. So basically, you treat a separation like any form of business arrangement, unfortunately. If you want something documented, if the parties can agree, get it documented and move on. The challenge with all this type of stuff that I find over the years is that people want to put their head in the sand and not deal with the issues because they're emotionally frustrated.
Exactly. I was going to say that's very emotional. They're thinking, well, it should be simple. Why do I need a lawyer? Can't we just work it out? And as you know, you'll tell Jim and I this morning that you have lots of cases where it just doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't work like that. And the complicating factor is, and this is where lawyers get kicked in the shins all the time, is that someone will go to the parties will talk about a situation and they'll discuss it and they will basically in their own minds sort of be happy with it. As a lawyer, they go to a lawyer and the lawyer is bound by professional ethics to advise the client of what they could get if they went to court. And in fact, if you're making consent orders under the family law court, the solicitor has to indeed sign a certificate saying precisely that they have advised the client of what their maximum rights would be, but notwithstanding that, they're happy to go into these consent positions. So you go to a lawyer, the lawyer has to tell you what you might get. Then people think, oh, maybe I'm not getting as much as what I should do. And what agreement that the parties thought they had all goes pear-shaped. And then the lawyer gets blamed for having caused the problem.
But if I can just jump in there as well. So if you're advising a client of the maximum benefit they can get, no doubt that will be also maximum effort on your behalf. And again, you get the kick in the shins because you've got to revise what that cost is going to be for the client. How do you work through that with the client to balance all that out?
Oh, it's a nightmare. It's complicated because you've got to try to explain the value proposition that you're putting to them whilst they're in a highly emotional state when they don't want to be dealing with the issue at all. So it's very frustrating for the lawyer to deal with this, and it's just something you have to try to learn over the years of dealing with people with these types of matters. And you know, in some cases, having a box of tissues on the table, whilst it seems a bit trite, is needed. Having a box of tissues and doing wills and doing family law property settlements is something that is a necessary tool that a solicitor needs to have, because it is an emotionally frustrating and stressful time for anyone.
Steve, thanks for sharing that. And Darren, that was an excellent question, because it opened up so many things. And the thing I took away from that conversation was that people need to sit down, if they really value two things, their assets and the distribution of those assets, then they need to sit down and talk to someone like Steve and lawyers who can help them in their goals and what they want to try and do. That's a really important takeout for me, rather than, as Steve said, I think, burying your head in the sand. Steve, as we get older, I mean, I'm in my 60s now. Unfortunately, my parents had passed away, but they would be in their 90s and so on. One of the things I talk to my friends about is their parents and what they're doing to go into a home and different things like that. That must be a very difficult, particularly if dementia or some debilitating disease takes over and they need to get some care. Can I just, if mum was alive, just go and say, just take her to a home and go and do that? Or is there a legal process in that? Sorry, it sounds complicated then.
Look, it is complicated in that it depends upon the level of mental
capacity
of the particular person. If they've got the mental capacity, then they still try to – the law wants someone to have control of their own life and destiny. So to the extent that a person can do so, the law tries to give them that. Now, there are documents that people can enter into that allow the courts to allow a person to grant to others power over their financial assets and for their care needs. In New South Wales, there are two documents. In other states, there's just one. They're melded together. And for reasons that I've never understood, in New South Wales, we have a schism between financial control of a person's estate and their health, personal and care needs whilst they're alive. And generally, you are stupid to have two different people, one looking after finances, one looking after care, because if the person who's looking after care doesn't have control of the financial resources, then making decisions which they can't pay for seems a bit futile. But so we certainly recommend in our firm that the one person is given control of both. So you would need in New South Wales to grant to someone what's known as power of attorney and grant to them an enduring guardianship. There are two forms. There are enduring powers of attorney, enduring guardianships, which allow the person to whom the powers are granted the right to make decisions for and on behalf of the person, even if they become physically or mentally incapable of making decisions for themselves. If the person doesn't give those types of rights, what you then need to do is someone who cares for the person would make an application to the Protective Commission of NCAT in New South Wales, and they would then make an application saying this person hasn't left these particular documents and we need to care for them. The NCAT people will hear the matter, and if they believe that you're a fit and proper person to look after the individual, then they will grant you an order giving you the same powers that you would have under a power of attorney or in guardianship. If they don't think you're appropriate, then they will generally appoint the public trustee as the body having those powers, and then the public trustee office will then make all the decisions for and on behalf of the particular person. So in a nutshell, they're it. But again, talking with your lawyer when you're doing your estate planning, so as part of your wills in New South Wales, you have a suite of documents being the will, a power of attorney, and enduring guardianship.
Steve, unfortunately, we've run out of time. I can't believe I listened so intently. Darren and I were looking at each other, raising our eyes, going, this is incredible information. Can I ask you, by way of invitation on behalf of Darren and I on Spotlight for 90.5, to come into the studio, if you'd be so kind, if you're seeing clients in, and I know you have an office in Western Sydney, to come and spend half an hour to three quarters of an hour, and just maybe take some calls from people in a general sense, because this is of a general nature and it's not specific, and just help our listeners understand a little bit more about this whole process of the legal world in which they operate with regards to their assets and so on.
I would love to take that opportunity to try to give some peace of mind to people on a general basis. Absolutely.
Stephen, thank you so much. We'll even give you a scone or something like that.
I'll cook the scones.
And we'll cook the scones. Now, what we need is a song, an artist that you like, so that we can leave the show with a song that you really like. And we don't care what it is. Tell
George
us.
George Benson's Greatest Love of All.
Perfect choice.
Great choice. Stephen Brown, Edion Lawyers, thanks again for being with us. We'll be in touch. Over and out. We're just so grateful you've joined us this morning on Spotlight.
It was a great pleasure, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to try to help some people.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Darren. Thanks, Jim. Bye.
Alive 90.5.